Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 18th year. As always, I'm your host, Jess Marquez, and our guests today on this special dual episode are none other than Susan Hensel and Joseph Grad to talk about their time spent together at the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board, their new gaming law firm, Hensel Grad, and their take on the gaming industry at large and its current regulatory environment. This podcast is sponsored by IGT, featuring its new multi-level progressive Mystery of the Lamp. Initial test bank numbers show strong performance, and it's no mystery why players love these enchanting MLPs. Mystery of the Lamp includes a persistence feature that builds anticipation and bonuses that can be combined for massive rewards. Available exclusively on the all-new Peak Curve 49, this is a combination designed to give your floor a higher ceiling. Learn more at igt.com/mysteryofthelamp. Susan, Joe, thank you guys so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thank you so much for having us. Thanks to you and to Roger Gross and GGB. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Very well.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. So I guess just to get started, obviously, you know, it's always a little bit awkward to talk about yourself. I understand that. But if you could you guys just give a little background for each of you and kind of how you guys got into gaming specifically? Because I know it's kind of a you know, people who end up in gaming, you know, it's usually a long road. So kind of how did that end up and how'd you get to where you are here?
So I'll start. And like a lot of people that I meet in the gaming business, I did not go looking for a career in gaming. I actually started my career as a television news reporter. So it has been a long trip to get where I am today. But basically, I was working in state government while I went to law school and then became an assistant general counsel in the governor's office of general counsel. And I was there when the Gaming Act passed in Pennsylvania. And I was tapped to be the first person in PA to start implementing the Gaming Act shortly after the Gaming Act was passed. So I had the opportunity to travel to Nevada and New Jersey and Delaware, and I've worked with some great regulators in those jurisdictions who shared information with me as I tried to get my arms around what is this thing called gaming. And at the same time, was working to lay the foundation for the creation of the Gaming Control Board, which was the first new agency in Pennsylvania to come into existence in 30 years. And when that agency started, I became their first official hire and then became the first director of licensing for the board, and had a great experience there. And during my tenure, was able to become the two-time president of the International Association of Gaming Regulators. And so that's my story. That's how I ended up in gaming.
Okay. Well, unlike Susan and most people in the industry, I'm not surprised at all that I ended up being a gaming lawyer. Okay. From an early age, I was interested in both law and gambling. I grew up in Northeast Pennsylvania, where gambling is firmly entrenched in the culture. Spent my youth caddying at a local country club, where, you know, membership talk of sports betting, casino gambling down the shore in Atlantic City, not to mention, you know, the significant Calcuttas being held at the venue itself. You know, there was always some chatter about, you know, would the big Calcutta go off that year, because a lot of judges and lawyers participated, and there was a wondering whether the state police would come, and they never did for the most part. But it was quite the intersection of law and gambling. And had I known that was an actual career path when I was young, I probably would have been very interested in it. So when Pennsylvania enacted the PA Racehorse and Development Gaming Act in 2004, and I was offered an opportunity to interview, you know, I certainly jumped at it. I knew one thing at that point, which is that Pennsylvanians love to gamble, and that this was going to be a big success. So I got the job, was offered a job in the Office of Chief Counsel, and was eventually assigned to the Bureau of Licensing, where Susan was the director. And that's where we began our relationship. We were working together, although Susan might claim that I was working for her. I think, we'll let her explain that.
Yeah, so that actually obviously ties right into where I was going to go next. So speaking of the intersection of gambling and law, kind of what did you guys work together on at the gaming board, and what were some of your shared experiences there?
Well, we worked together in the very early days. Basically, we worked on everything.
Gotcha. I figured.
But in particular, as the director of licensing, I had to put in place a framework for the bureau and how it would function. And that was everything from developing licensing classification systems to writing and rewriting regulations, developing policies and procedures. We had to come up with a whole process for how we would present applicants to the board. So we had this background investigation and suitability report writing process that I oversaw, and we had to develop that and how we would get an applicant in front of the board to make a decision. Joe, as he said, was a lawyer for the Office of Chief Counsel, but at that time, everything revolved around licensing. That was where everything began and ended. So he was essentially assigned to support the Bureau of Licensing and me. And he was a lawyer who I relied on very heavily in the decision-making processes. I found Joe's counsel to be very intelligent and found that we worked together just extremely well. We frequently had our heads together to try and figure out what the latest question from the board or the industry or how to interpret what the legislature meant by a particular provision of the law. We were constantly working through issues.
Right. Just to echo that, one of the, in terms of my recollection, one of the most important pieces of work that we were always involved in is making, really made all the complex licensing decisions together. There wasn't a day that would go by where a lawyer, we didn't have a meeting or call with a lawyer who was trying to get some investor, owner, financier, officer, director away from the licensing process. And, it was a new industry. And, although we could look to Nevada and New Jersey, we had our own Pennsylvania gaming statute to enforce. And, it was certainly a daunting task, but I think our relationship was truly forged in that cauldron of having a lot of pressure put on us to make the accurate decisions that not everyone agreed upon at the time, but I think we were happy with the overall work product.
Right. I think early on, Joe and I both appreciated that the decisions that we made couldn't just apply to one set of facts. They had to be, we had to be looking at the long game. We had to be setting good precedent for Pennsylvania. And so we always tried to keep that element, that dimension in mind in our decision making. And I think at the end of the day, we did a pretty good job of trying to help the industry as much as we could within the framework of the law and the regulations while keeping in mind the big picture of what we were deciding.
Right. It was no easy task dealing with a lot of the legendary gaming lawyers that came before us and knew we were newbies at this. I thought they could not push us around, but influence us in their right direction. And so it was challenging, but it was also fun, mm-hmm. at the same time.
So you guys touched on a few different things there, and I kind of want to press a little bit more on some of the points. And I want to have a general conversation about Pennsylvania and the market and everything like that, but I kind of wanted to touch on some of the licensing things that you guys were talking about, because I think it is interesting how anytime you're first at something, especially in a government setting, it's obviously defined by trial and error, but I'm sure there's also a sense of pride, as you guys have talked about, when you get to see this thing that you've built and kind of see how it's evolved and grows over time. And I'm especially interested in the aspect of like the licensing process, because it's one thing that somebody like myself, who's not necessarily in tune with the process, doesn't necessarily think about first, but obviously it's a huge important factor, and especially in the beginning of a market. What were some of the biggest things that went into those decisions that you made in terms of licensing individuals and companies and things like that? What were some of the considerations that you guys were dealing with, especially for you know, a market that was new and, you know, you were kind of dealing with, like you just said, you know, more experienced people all around you. What was that process like and what were some of the considerations that went into it?
Well, I think one of the things we came to appreciate early on is how complicated it really is. And
definitely.
That was one of the, I remember speaking with my first chairman and he would say, Susan, what is taking so long? I don't know. why aren't we just getting these companies licensed? And I would show him an organizational chart that would have, you know, six layers of entities and all sorts of principles that would flow off of that. And then questions of percentages and who needed to be in and who needed to be out and how to deal with the investment layer and just the trusts and all kinds of complications that, you know, the devil's in the detail. And so I think early on, we came to appreciate the complexity of it all and had to get that into a manageable decision-making tree. And, you know, that's something that Joe and I worked on. And we also, you know, we recognized if something wasn't going in the right direction, we were open to revamping things, you know, taking a reasoned approach to what's working and what isn't working.
Right. I think that, you know, we were influenced by some of the earlier jurisdictions like Nevada and New Jersey. Like I said, we also had the PA Gaming Act, but we also, you know, made our own decisions about what we thought would be in the best interest of gaming in Pennsylvania. We were dealing with a significantly higher tax rate of, you know, mid-50s. There were early questions, you know, from the industry whether that kind of tax rate was actually viable. So when there were sources of capital and investment.
Not to interrupt you, but it's not that we're ever having that conversation anymore, right? They keep going.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it was definitely, we definitely kept that in the front of our minds, is that we needed sources of capital, sources of investment to stand up this industry. And that we were going to do, I think what Susan and I always committed to is we were going to do what we thought was in the best interest. And if we succeeded or failed, at least we were doing the right thing. And we weren't just going to establish rules and regulations as red tape so that people couldn't, you know, later second guess us. We were going to do what we thought was right, which probably in my case, probably was courage. In Susan's case, was probably a dose of naivety in mine. But nevertheless, you know, that's what we did.
Speaking of gaming in Pennsylvania, and now as somebody like myself who was born and raised in Nevada, it can be a little bit, I don't know how to describe it, but when I look at other states and gaming, I guess it can be a little bit of a weird experiment. But I do think that Pennsylvania has definitely become, in my opinion, one of the top gaming markets in the U.S. and one that has certainly grown over the last 10 years plus. For you guys, obviously, you've been involved with it, you know, knee deep. What do you think Pennsylvania's place, I guess, in the U.S. gaming ecosystem is? And I guess kind of a two-parter, how has the market evolved? How have you guys seen the market evolve since, I say, the time that you started until now?
You know, I think first and foremost, when Pennsylvania launched, it was a disruptor. Like mm-hmm. I mentioned before, the high tax rate. Mm-hmm. Which really hadn't been seen in a major commercial U.S. market before.
Okay.
And that it was successful and that I could deliver significant revenues to state coffers, which obviously incentivized other states to follow fairly quickly, like Ohio, Maryland, Virginia. And it had, unfortunately, a significant negative impact on New Jersey, you know, up to 35-40% of New Jersey's gambling revenues were coming from Pennsylvania. So it also disrupted the New Jersey market, and they had to pursue different pathways to success.
Right. We were just at the International Masters of Gaming Law Conference in Napa, and Dave Rebuck was talking about exactly that point. And he talked about how the New Jersey revamped its entire regulatory structure and how they had to go looking for new and creative ways to attract dollars to New Jersey. And that, you know, they launched iGaming. And I think that you could even draw a line to the sports wagering being launched in New Jersey and the push that they made to get that done as a result of Pennsylvania coming in and disrupting the marketplace. And in terms of how Pennsylvania has evolved, it's evolved substantially. When the act was first passed in 2004, Pennsylvania was a slots-only jurisdiction, and the act has been amended twice since then, first to expand to table games, and then to expand to the whole range of casino and online products, including fantasy sports, iCasino, sports wagering. That was authorized before PASPA fell in one of the amendments to the act. Also satellite casinos in Pennsylvania, and even VGTs at truck stops. So the act has evolved, and gaming in Pennsylvania has evolved substantially from those early days.
And kind of touching back, to go back just a second to the topic of licensing, what was that like in terms of the iGaming and all that other stuff that came in while you were there in terms of the licensing process? Was that difficult? I would assume back then, you know, not like now where it's obviously the topic on everyone's minds, but in years past, I'm assuming it was a lot more gray and kind of just difficult to manage. Was that right?
Well, the philosophy from the beginning was that we were going to fold the new verticals into the existing structure that we had. So okay. We wanted to work to, for the ease of the industry and for the ease of the regulator, we weren't going to create some whole new licensing system. We were going to classify the new companies, the new technologies into the existing framework. But what we needed to do was get educated on how online gaming worked, how sports wagering worked. Now, luckily, I had had the opportunity and had really made it my mission to learn everything I could about iGaming before the act was even amended. I really made it a point to meet people who were in the iGaming space, who were in New Jersey, and try to get myself educated. And then when the law was amended and iGaming was authorized in Pennsylvania, I was able to utilize the contacts that I had made and invite companies in to then educate the staff, the rest of the, you know, other people at the board about the different technologies, because this was just new to us. And we were able to fold those companies into our licensing structure, but we had to understand, a whole new delivery system for casino products and then sports wagering. You know, there aren't a lot of people, or at least there weren't at the time, a lot of people who had experience in the United States as regulators or even in the industry for those verticals. And we saw a lot of new companies come in from outside the United States, and we saw a whole range of companies that made up the technology stack to deliver those products to the players.
And fortunately for me, I was long retired from the Pennsylvania Gaming Control Board and was now representing clients trying to get licensed. And guiding them through the pathway is a lot easier than actually developing it.
I would imagine, yeah. So in terms of growth potential, do you guys see a lot of potential there? I mean, in my opinion, I would say, just looking at it from a 30,000 foot perspective, if you want to say like the third place for U.S. gaming markets is probably up for grabs behind Atlantic City and Vegas. Do you think Pennsylvania can kind of grab that third spot, or where do you see the growth potential for the market?
Well, in terms of ranking, I think it depends on what you're measuring. If you're looking if you're looking at tax revenue generation, Pennsylvania has been and continues to be number one in the nation.
That's true.
But it definitely ranks in the top markets. In March of this year, the Gaming Control Board announced that it had passed $500 million in monthly revenue for the very first time since gaming was authorized or launched in 2006. And so clearly it's a growing market, and I see no reason why the marketplace won't continue to grow and why Pennsylvania won't continue to be one of the top U.S. gaming markets.
Sure. It's not a destination market, but it's one of the most, you know, highly populated, most populated states that have, or definitely the most populated state in the country that has full online casino. So in terms of the sheer population and then all of the full suite of verticals certainly makes for you know, one of the top gaming markets in the country.
Definitely, definitely. So to turn away from Pennsylvania to back to you guys specifically, so the inspiration behind the firm Hensel Grad, can you tell me a little bit about it, kind of the formation of it? Just what was the idea and how did it come about?
Well, Joe and I had, as we've talked about, always worked together very well. There's a great synergy between us. We know that we are capable of solving complex problems in a manner that's, you know, create win-win solutions. We've been able to develop and implement strategy. And we just decided that if that skill set and that synergy could work in one forum, then it could work in another. And we decided to team our well-tested track record of working together with our regulatory experience and see if that could be of benefit to companies that are working to navigate U.S. regulatory schemes, which in the U.S. are state-based and different depending on where you're trying to launch your business.
Well, I'd say in the last, since we launched a little over 2 years ago, and I'd say in that period, nobody has ever asked me the question, why did you partner up with Susan Hensel? You know, obviously, she has a great reputation. She's highly respected in the industry. She has contacts, relationships throughout the world. And I knew what it was like to deal and work with her, which was an absolute pleasure in the past. And it's continued.
Well, I will say, as somebody who, as we talked about off air, but I previously worked for a pretty prominent law firm. And I will say that talking with you guys in just the short amount that I have, I do think that you have a pretty healthy partner relationship, more so than maybe some of the other attorneys I've worked with. So I definitely give you some props there.
It's great to hear.
In terms of what makes you guys unique, so what are some of the things that you would say to, prospective clients, anyone listening, that what makes Hensel Grad stand out from other gaming law firms and what makes it unique?
I'm never going to tell a prospective client that we're the only firm in the U.S. That could provide adequate representation in the gaming space. Okay, it's just not true. There's several that I think are competitive with us. I think our secret sauce is that we're both former regulators, that we understand, you know, the unique regulatory mindset, having both occupied that seat. You know, we understand the perspective, the goals, the fears of the regulator. And it's that little edge, I think, that we can provide to our clients that over time makes for a significant difference in terms of the quality of the work that we can provide.
And I would add that we're new, we're growing, we're hungry, and clients that come to us, they're going to get partner level attention. And I think that that's, you know, it's another unique piece that we can offer.
So you guys mentioned, obviously, the experience as regulators, which we've talked about. And I'm kind of interesting to kind of get into this section of the conversation, because we at GGB don't always get to highlight, or how would you say, due to the restrictions of the job, per se, we don't often get to talk to regulators and get their opinions on things and whatnot. One thing that I'm wondering, talking with you guys, I have this great opportunity with the both of you, is what would be your advice for working alongside regulators, and kind of what are some of the best practices in terms of regulatory relationship that you guys would offer?
Well, I would say, the most important is adopting, you know, the correct mindset, which is that you must be, selectively assertive. You can't be overly passive. And the worst is to be overly aggressive. It's kind of it's a pick your battles mentality. And to me, you know, I would never push back on a regulator unless two criteria were satisfied. The one being it was an important issue for my client, a substantial important issue for my client. And I thought, I truly believe that we were on the right side of it. And if those two were not met, I wouldn't go forward. I would advise that this is not the right battle to wage. I mean, I remember Susan and I would sit in offices early on, you know, at the board, and you'd see the occasional inexperienced Pennsylvania gaming lawyer who thought that this real overly adversarial approach, you know, was the way to go. But then you'd see the really experienced New Jersey attorneys come in, and some of the ones from Nevada, and they just had a different approach, you know? And so, you know, I learned a lot from that. I'm sure Susan did as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And building on the picking your battles, I think it's important to recognize when the regulator has discretion and when they don't, and to not try to wage battles with the regulator when their hands are tied because it's something is in a statute. And we had this early on with the tax rate. We would have people come in and they would complain to the regulator about the tax rate. Well, there's just nothing the regulator can do about the tax rate. It's legislatively set. So that picking your battles is a, you know, is an important piece of advice. And I really think in the US that the gaming regulator wants to see the industry succeed. I think that there's very much a mindset of a partnership. Now, obviously the industry has to operate within the confines of the laws and the regulations, but I do think it's important that it is not an adversarial relationship and that you can look for creative solutions. If you understand why the regulator is doing something, like why is this regulation so important? What are you trying to accomplish? Now you can talk to the regulator, perhaps with creative ideas for alternatives to how to accomplish the same goal, how to achieve that same regulatory result, but maybe in a way that is less complicated for your company. So, and, you know, I just think that it's important, as Joe says, to understand the regulatory mindset.
Definitely. And it never hurts to mention the fact, always keep in front of mind, that regulators are people too. I say that too very often in interviews and such. And kind of as jumping off of that, what do you guys see as sort of maybe both inherent and how would you say developing challenges that are facing regulation and gaming regulators today?
Me to take that? Yeah, I'll go first there. I mean, to me, you know, mine is more, is really 30,000 feet.
Okay.
In terms of, look, you know, my fear is that politicians and legislators, they expect too much from the gaming industry.
Okay.
They expect to impose a significant, huge tax to fund some extraordinary government project. And then they also want that same operator to develop and deliver a robust problem gambling program. And it's just not possible to ask everything, you know, of the operator, to ask them to deliver so much. I mean, to me, you know, in my mind, the tax revenue, while it's important, while it stimulates the enactment of legislation, it's a secondary goal. I mean, the first is that regulated legal gambling is good public policy. If it's conducted correctly and it protects players, it is sound public policy that we want to encourage and foster, and hopefully will sustain itself in the future in the United States. We know what the past is like. We know what the 50s and 60s in this country were like in terms of the major metropolitan areas and the effects of prohibition. But somehow, you know, in this country, we understand that with respect to alcohol, why we would never go back and try to prohibit alcohol, but we don't have the same approach to gambling. And they're very similar, if not identical. And we need to take that approach, that having it legal is a strong market for this, okay? But we need it to be well-regulated. And that is a sound policy goal.
And the reason we need it to be well regulated is because the fundamental reason for gaming regulation is to ensure a sustainable industry. And one of the challenges that face regulators today is ensuring that sustainable industry in what is today an extremely rapidly evolving industry. You know, for the longest time, we had a slow roll of gaming expansion in the land-based world across the country. today we see new jurisdictions launching sports betting all of the time. And that presents new challenges for the regulator, and they have to take that big picture approach to sustainability, and they have to do it in a really rapidly evolving environment.
Right. So in short, I mean, in my view, we want the government to be the regulator, not the partner of these enterprises. And I think that is, I think that's the proper order for a sustainable future.
And I want to touch on, some specifics here in just a second, but as I just want to take it a second to acknowledge that as somebody, like I said, from born and raised in Reno, Nevada, and like what you guys talked about with sustainability and public policy, I would definitely second that as somebody, you know, who went to school and did everything basically on the backs of the gaming industry. So I definitely agree with what you said. Specifically though, with regards to, you guys mentioned sports betting, and I would probably throw iGaming into this as well, although it's definitely not on the same track in terms of legalization and implementation and whatnot. But obviously in recent years, sports wagering has kind of become like just shot out of a cannon pretty much in terms of the US, in terms of spread, influence, everything like that. Do you guys expect to see any changes in the way that the sports betting in particular is handled by regulators, or kind of what do you guys see there? Because to me, it seems like that is the kind of the biggest piece of the industry right now that is undergoing perhaps the most change the quickest.
Well, I think the last 5 years, the focus has been on the excitement of new launches. Who's next? How many eyeballs? How many clicks? What kind of revenue is being generated? How fast can they launch? Can they meet the NFL schedule, et cetera? And I think we're really entering a new phase now with sports betting in the U.S., where the regulators, the press, lawmakers, the industry are really starting to take a look at what is out there and are saying, is what we're doing working? Is what we're doing working from an advertising standpoint, from a problem gambling standpoint, or do we need some refinement? In terms of change, we're already seeing change. We already see that with respect to advertising, New Jersey has just announced that it's putting out new advertising guidelines. We see some state lawmakers talking about possible restrictions on advertisement. We see the AGA has come out with an update to its responsible marketing code with respect to certain language like free bets and risk-free wagering. Several states have banned the use of those terms. And we're also seeing scrutiny applied to the relationships between sportsbooks and colleges and universities. So I think, you know, I think that reassessment period is underway, and that is likely to continue.
Yeah, I think we're 5 years, maybe one day, 5 years post PASPA.
Yep.
And look, I think that regulators, I mean, they tend to be reactive. Okay. So as you see kind of the trickle of negative byproduct coming from the legalization of sports betting, I think you'll see those issues addressed, whether it's advertising, problem gambling, et cetera. I think long-term, I think you'll see some other bodies enter the regulatory fold in a stronger way. I think long-term, will you see Congress enact laws dealing with advertising, potentially data privacy, problem gambling? I think that's a very strong likelihood. And I think given the enormous stake that the leagues have, the professional sports leagues have in this country, and the enormous power that they wield, I think they will certainly long-term get involved more in the regulation of sports betting as we proceed.
That's fascinating. That's very interesting. I'll ask just one more regulatory question, I promise. Touching on iGaming, which is something that is a little bit hard to, I guess, grasp, not from a general perspective, but for someone like myself who has not been in the industry very long, I look at iGaming and it's kind of a strange conversation because there's so much hype surrounding it, and it seems as though everybody, it's all for operators, like all roads lead to iGaming in some form, in some way, in some time, shape, whatever. It seems to be a very sought after prize in some respect, yet obviously it's legalization, as I said earlier, has been not nearly on par with sports betting. I mean, you basically have New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut, and then that's, and you know, I think what there might be two or three others sprinkled around the country. So what has it been like to see, you know, Pennsylvania has gotten in on this market very early? What do you think has kind of prevented that from happening across the country? Or I guess just broadly, what is your sense of the iGaming market in the US as it stands right now, having dealt with it in an intimate way that you guys have?
You know, I think in terms of why it hasn't expanded, I think overall, you know, U.S. politicians and the public tend to view regulation of gambling through access, through limiting access. And I think that even with sports betting, you can obviously have online sports betting, but there's only so many NFL games. There's only so many NBA games to have, right? So there is limited access just because the content's limited.
I got you.
But I think there's always that fear that if you allow online blackjack, that people will just sit on their phones the entire day and night. I think that is just the mentality, even though that hasn't been the case in some of the early adopters. It's just the mentality we've always had. I mean, going back to Nevada and Atlantic City, you know, people were comfortable with that as long as you had to travel, as long as gambling wasn't in your backyard. But then when it came to your backyard, people realized it wasn't the end of the world. You know, people might take a monthly trip to the casino, or they might have a great restaurant there that they would frequent. But yeah, so I think Americans have always looked at gaming in that way, that if you have full access to it, you are going to fully utilize all the time.
And I also think that unlike sports, the iCasino movement, if you want to call it that, doesn't really have an advocate. On the sports betting side, you have the leagues who have now decided that they're behind sports wagering. You have all of the sports fans. You have everybody's, you know, got some connection and excitement about sports. So I think that there's just much more advocacy to pass sports wagering than you see on the iCasino side. There just isn't a united voice to push for its authorization.
Sure, and probably a less, almost as important, but maybe more pedestrian reason is simply that the collective states are probably in better health, maybe post-COVID relief money, and they don't have that need to find another revenue source. I think that's the problem. That's the, you know, one of the fuelers of gaming within state governments is that, unlike the federal government, states can't print money.
Right.
And that
right.
There's always a need. There's always a need, you know, for more revenue. And there's always, you know, so I think that's been a little bit of a headwind in terms of why you haven't seen expanded online casino in the US.
Yeah, and I, once again, the money wins out, right? The money is the answer in the end. I should have known. But so we've had a, you know, a very wide ranging conversation. I thank you guys so much for joining me today. I'll get you out of here on this. This is always one of my favorite questions to ask, but you know, what lies ahead for Hensel Grad and the next few years? What's the things that you guys got planned? And yeah, just what's the future plans? I always love to end on a positive note.
We think the future is bright. You know, the fun part about this industry is that it's ever changing. There's always a new company, a new idea, a new technology, a new market. And you know, we plan to be here to help companies maximize everything that the U.S. has to offer and to do it with the greatest of regulatory ease possible.
I echo that, onward and upward, and we'll see you back in a few more years for another conversation.
I sure hope so. Well, thank you guys so much for joining me. Usually, I mean, I can't even imagine how much it would cost normally to have this kind of expertise with me to talk with such topics. So thank you guys so much for taking the time, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It's been our pleasure.
We hope you enjoyed this week's podcast sponsored by IGT. Learn more about IGT's new Mystery of the Lamp at igt.com/mysterythelamp. To learn more about Susan, Joe, and their journey with Hensel Grad, visit ggbmagazine.com. Subscribe to GGB News to get all the news of the gaming industry delivered to your desktop every Monday morning. And be sure to use the coupon code GGB180 for a free subscription. Don't miss an episode of the GGB podcast by subscribing on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify today. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.